Halima, hi.
Is that Chris Molina?
It sure is.
You look so grown up.
It's that beard that I've been working on since our first pilot aired all the way earlier this year. Hey, this is Entertain Us from Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're bringing you a second pilot today.
A lot of time has passed since our last episode. It's been an entire summer. How was yours, Chris?
It was pretty good. I bought a house. That was definitely a thing that I did. That was kind of nuts. What about yourself?
I went to Philadelphia. I have a new niece, so spent some time with her.
Sounds like you had a good time.
Yeah, it was a pretty good time. Well, we're going to be talking about time today. We're going to look at the time and love and care that goes into things like making a mixtape.
We'll also find out why we spend a little too much time rewatching our favorite movies.
And we'll be looking at the end of time and our infatuation with the apocalypse.
We'll also look at a specific slice of time, 6 weeks in 1991 that changed rock and roll history.
Hey, why are the lights going out?
Joining us now, a 6'2" music journalist originally from Appleton, Wisconsin. He's written for Rolling Stone, Pitchfork, and he's currently a staff writer for UpRocks. He's the author of the book, Your Favorite Band is Killing Me. And he's here with us now, Steven Hayden.
Hey, Steve, welcome to Entertain Us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. Well, this song that we're hearing now, Enter Sandman, is one that you reference in an article comparing some of the biggest rock albums from 1991. We'll get to why we just played that song in a second here, but as far as I understand, you've got six really essential albums that came out all within a short amount of time together in 1991. What were these albums?
Well, you have the Black Album by Metallica. You have Pearl Jam 10, their first record. You have the two Use Your Illusion albums by Guns N' Roses, and then Nevermind by Nirvana. So that those records all came out August and September of 1991, within about a six-week span.
So the reason that we played Enter Sandman there is here's a song that when it came out in 1991, you know, it was kind of like this new, exciting, gritty song. And now, you know, it's sort of turned into this arena rock, you know, hey, here are your Milwaukee Bucks sort of thing. So I guess I'm wondering, when you're looking back on these albums, as a critic, like, how hard is it to hear a song like this now when we've attached so many different meanings to it?
Well, first of all, I don't think you can separate the baggage that gets attached to these albums. I think that's impossible. You know, like, the reason why we're talking about these albums 26 years later is the fact that they did make a big impact on people's lives.
So I want to play a couple of these songs from these 1991 albums, because, you know, we're talking about these songs, and I think these are so iconic, and we attach so many emotions, feelings, life memories to some of these songs. I want to play a couple for you and just hear what 1991 Steven Hayden was doing when these songs were popular and what it reminds you of. All right, what was 1991 Steven Hayden doing when this song was a hit?
Well, you know, all of these albums, they came out right as I was entering eighth grade. And as anyone who has been in the eighth grade will tell you, that is like one of the worst years of your life.
True.
So true.
I turned 14 in September of 1991, where your hormones and your body, you know, have betrayed you, you know.
Yes.
And, you know, you want girls to like you, but they will never like you. You know, your face has exploded into horrible complexion. You know, what that record was, you know, it was a bunch of outcasts striking out against sort of the popular kids in music at that time. And the outcasts took over. So that was incredibly inspiring for me at that point in my life.
At home, drawing pictures of mountaintops with him on top, lemon yellow sun.
All right, 1991, Steven Hayden. Let's hear the story there.
You know, Nirvana and Pearl Jam, they had a rivalry at that time. It was mostly generated by Kurt Cobain because he accused them of being a sellout grunge band.
We never had a fight, ever. I just have always hated their band.
So, you know, I hated Pearl Jam, but I also secretly loved Pearl Jam. But eventually, I gave up the ruse and I came out as a Pearl Jam fan after that. But yeah, in the early going, you know, if I would have heard Jeremy, I probably would have pretended not to like it.
And looking back on these albums now, we're also familiar with Enter Sandman. We're also familiar with Smells Like Teen Spirits. You have this quote in this article that I wanted to ask you about. You write, "At this point, I don't know what I'm hearing when I play Smells Like Teen Spirit or Alive or November Rain or Nothing Else Matters or Give It Away. Am I hearing the song or my impression of the song shaped by my own experiences and the overbearing cultural context?" Talk more about what you mean there.
Well, you know, with a band like Nirvana, I think especially, I mean, there's so many documentaries about Nirvana. There's so many books. You know, the fact that Kurt Cobain killed himself in 1994, that has really changed how that band is perceived. You know, that they're not looked at now the same way that they were in 1991. In 1991, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit comes out, and the first time I heard that song, I thought it was pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the title of that song, it's referring to an underarm deodorant aimed at teenagers.
Right.
And, yeah.
But now when we talk about Smells Like Teen Spirit, it's always as this sort of generational touchstone. You know, it has a lot of weight to it. And, you know, you can't really hear these as songs anymore. They're cultural constructs now.
And I want to get back to this idea of music rivalries in just a second here, but we've got one more smash hit from 1991 that we're going to play for you here. Let's take a listen.
Then I'm walking in Memphis, but do I really feel the way I feel?
I'm sure that was one that you were rushing to tell all your friends that you were super into, right?
Well, you know, here's the thing about me is that, you know, I feel like I probably liked walking in Memphis because there was like a middle-aged man inside of me. You know, like a 45-year-old guy wearing a leather jacket, you know. I swear, every single waiting room I've been in, like in the last 26 years, has played that song at some point. Like, that song does not go away. It is indestructible. So Mark Cohn, he's got to be sitting on like a pile of walking in Memphis cash just from the spins of that song. You know, so hats off to him, man.
He's getting like millions of dollars from dentist offices across the world. It's obscene.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just think of how different your waiting room experiences would be without Mark Cohn. You know, like, he's really soundtracked some of the most tedious moments of your life with that song. So, you know, and he made it a little bit more soulful, you know, sitting in waiting rooms. So, you know, thanks, Mark Cohn.
Well, going back to what you said about rivalries, you talked about this Nirvana-Pearl Jam rivalry. Why is it that we do get so fired up about these rivalries, which, like, ultimately really don't have a winner?
You know, I think this is just part of what people put into pop culture. People will pit two artists against each other that are different in, like, one or two maybe significant ways, and they'll basically treat them as sort of representatives of, like, different ideologies. Like, if you love Nirvana, in 1991 that meant that you were into sort of, like, underground, weird punk rock music.
Mm.
And if you were into Pearl Jam, that meant that you were, like, more for, like, arena rock, or that you were, like, siding with, like, the popular kids in school. You know, and that's a very reductive way of putting it. That's not fair to either band. I mean, you know, both bands contain multitudes and that have nothing to do with, like, those sort of archetypes that were projected onto them.
Mm-hmm.
But that really was how a lot of people saw it. And even to this day, when people argue about those bands, those things will come up. And, again, when people do that, I think they're arguing about more than just the bands. I think that's one of the functions of pop culture. You know, we can't always argue about politics, and we can't always argue about religion. You know, because those get heated very quickly. But we can talk about favorite movies, and we can talk about favorite bands. It's kind of like the Cold War, you know? It was like, you can't fire nukes at each other, but we can do these sort of underhanded things. You know, it's like another way to fight a war without us destroying each other.
So you've been writing music reviews for a long time now. I guess I'm wondering, have you ever gone back and been tempted to revise a review that you did, like, you know, 15, 20 years ago? Like, you know, maybe in the paper somewhere, Stephen Hyden said, man, Sugar Ray's 1459 is the best album ever. Is there ever that temptation to go back and kind of revisit something, you know, through the lens of experience?
Well, by the way, if I did write that about Sugar Ray, I would go back and be even more superlative. You know, I'd bring even more compliments on that record. Yeah, I mean, I feel that way all the time. I feel that way about things I wrote 6 months ago or a year ago, much less 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's just part of, you know, being human. You know, if you're the type of person who listens to something for a week and then says, okay, this is how I feel about it, and then you feel that way forever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're a pretty close-minded person, I think. You know, like, you know, something that sounds good or bad today, it might sound different in 6 months. You know, like when you've had different experiences or you know, maybe music has changed. Maybe you've heard other records that kind of help you make sense of what you heard in the past. Like you didn't get it, but now you get it now. So I always look at that as a positive thing. You know, like a record review to me is never about setting your opinion in stone forever. It's a snapshot of how you felt that day when you wrote something.
All right, well, rock on, Stephen. We'll talk to you later. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Stephen Hayden is a staff writer for Up Rocks, and he's the author of Your Favorite Band Is Killing Me.
Chris, this song actually really reminds me of my mom.
How on earth does Nirvana remind you of your mom?
Well, because she used to call the Chronicles of Narnia the Chronicles of Nirvana.
Where did that even come from? Like, I'm just imagining her putting headphones on her pregnant belly, pumping in Smells Like Teen Spirits.
That is how I turned out this way. Well, speaking of which, Chris, have you ever seen the Chronicles of Narnia?
I haven't. What movie I have seen over and over again is Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, one of the finest films ever made.
I am not a movie rewatcher, but I will do it with TV, which is why I'm very curious as to why we rewatch movies over and over again when we know exactly what the ending is.
Well, hey, let's find out. We've got Rick Paulus here with us, who's done a little bit of research on this topic and happens to have his own personal obsession.
Hey, Rick, thanks for joining us.
How you doing?
We are going to play you a clip of a movie and see if you can place it. Here's a clue.
I am your singing telegram.
Of course. That is the hit film from 1985, Clue, starring Tim Curry and a wide range of other great actors and actresses of the era.
So you're pretty fond of this film. What's behind that?
So growing up, that was the movie that I had just the most access to somehow, that we had a VHS recording of it, and we didn't have cable growing up. And so that is what I would sit in front of the TV and pop in the VCR and just watch that pretty continuously.
And how many times have you seen it so far?
Easily over 100 times.
So what experience are you looking for when you watch this movie that you know the way it begins, you know the way it ends, you know everything that happens in between? What is it that compels you to go watch it, you know, a 150th time?
I mean, the best comparison to use is like if you have your favorite song or something, right? And you put it on because it makes you feel a certain way. There is some science that actually shows that people like the idea of almost being able to create it themselves because they know what's coming up next. And so they feel that they're making it in a way, if that makes sense.
And so we ended up having this conversation with our team after we read your article. And I feel like everyone had a different response. I personally have rewatched the show New Girl countless times, and I tend to do it when I need something that I don't want to pay too much attention to. How engaged are you, you know, when you watch Clue again?
It's no longer about like finding plot intricacies or even reciting lines. At this point, I know the whole all the lines front and back, so that doesn't even matter. And then at some point, it was about like noticing certain stuff in the background, whether it was like wardrobe or how just the movements of some of the actors. But even that was probably over around time number 50 or whatever. And so now it's really just letting the eyes glaze over and somehow just being in this sort of trance state.
Do you think nostalgia is also a piece of this? Are we also craving a chance to look back, maybe remember how we felt the first time we consumed this? Or even like if it's a movie that's made, you know, 10, 20 years ago, looking at things that maybe might not hold up or just happen today.
One of the studies that I get into in that piece was about how a lot of the memories that people develop over their life and like the most powerful memories come between the ages of 10 and 30, and they don't exactly know the reasons for that yet. There's a few different theories. One is just that's like the prime physical condition that most people are in, and so that means their brains are stronger in some capacity, and so that's why they go back to there. But also that's a time of like great social change throughout someone's life. And so there's totally a nostalgia thing with Clue. If I saw Clue for the first time last week, I wouldn't be watching it on like a crazy consistent basis.
So do you remember the first time you saw the movie and what it was like?
I remember like the living room and the VCR and kind of lying on the ground in front of it and just popping in the video with my feet for some reason into the VCR and like hitting play with my toe.
So what about the experience of sharing, Rick? Have you ever tried to get someone to appreciate Clue as much as you do?
Sure. Yeah, probably once a year or once every few years, I'll try to talk whoever I'm around into having a screening. Sometimes it works. And every time I think they enjoy the movie, because again, it's a perfect movie. There's actually either two kinds of Clue watchers that I found. People that have already, like me, seen it as a kid and love it. Or people that haven't seen it that are like, yeah, it's all right. Yeah, I mean, it's fine. I don't know why he's having a Clue party in 30 years after it was made. But yeah, it's fine.
I mean, I understand that because I feel very upset when I have been dying to show somebody something and then you show it to them and you're like, wait, this is the good part. Pay attention. And they're like, eh. My coworker tried to get me to watch David S. Pumpkins, the SNL skit, for about, I don't know, since last year.
What's my name?
David S. Pumpkins.
Any questions?
And then I finally watched it last week, and I was kind of like, eh. And I could see her face fall. I mean, why do we get so invested in making sure that other people like things as much as we do?
That's a great question. Because it becomes a way to show that, like, your opinion is valid or that you have good taste, I guess, in a certain way. And so if you present that to someone as, this is what I think is good, and then someone's like, yeah, it's not as good as you think it is, that's such a damning moment. And that's such a heartbreaking, like you're putting yourself out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically asking someone to marry you and then getting rejected. It's the same exact emotion.
I think it's 100% the equivalent.
So Rick, are you able to enjoy the actual board game? Or if it comes out at a party, are you like, no, man, that's okay. The movie's way better.
Well, the board game sucks. I mean, it's... we had fun with it back in the day, but I think that's kind of run its course. The movie, though, it's on a level of quality that you can't really judge.
That was writer Rick Paulus, who is something of a Clue super fan and really put himself out there by sharing that with us. So, speaking of which, Chris, do you ever feel vulnerable like that?
I feel vulnerable all the time.
Well, you are not alone. In our next segment, we're going to hear from people who got really vulnerable and poured their hearts out on mixtapes.
Looking forward to that. And for more, check us out online at wpr.org/entertainus. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Hashtag
psyched. You're listening to Entertain Us.
Less casual, more psyched.
Okay. Can you do a hashtag psyched? So I
can't spell it.
You're listening to Entertain Us from Wisconsin Public Radio.
How do I...
Hello. I just called.
Baby, come back.
Now, the making of a good compilation tape is a very subtle art. Many do's and don'ts. First of all, you're using someone else's poetry to express how you feel. This is a delicate thing.
So, Chris, do you have any mixtapes in your past?
Unfortunately, I do. I have a couple stored in boxes that I could probably still find if I wanted to. Did find one in my desk recently entitled Summer Jams with a Z 2010 that I did receive from an ex. What about you, Halima?
Wait, it was from 2010, and it was called Summer Jams with a Z?
Summer Jams with a Z.
I was expecting you to say, like, 1996.
Nope, this was a recent thing. I was totally okay with it. What about you?
Yeah, I had a mix that my best friend in middle school made for me. It was kind of inspired by a paranormal vampire romance that was very popular at the time that shall not be named.
But what I think we're learning here is that we all have a mixtape story. And we wanted to hear from you. We wanted to hear your stories.
Hi, can I bother you for a second?
Excuse me.
Hi. Hey, can I bother you for a second?
So we put a call out, and we got some pretty good stories in response.
And we also wanted to get NPR Music's Stephen Thompson's take on this. He's kind of an authority on mixtapes. Stephen, so are mixtapes really about the music?
Not necessarily. I think very often with a mixtape, you're sort of sending a little bit of a letter to the person in music form. You're mindful of the messaging, but you're also saying a little something about the music that you like. There's a little bit of vanity to sending a mixtape because you're presuming to know enough about music to converse with the person in that way.
Yeah, you wrote a piece sort of about mixtapes, and I want to read back one of the lines to you. You say, a crush mix may say, I like you, but what people like me really want to say is, I like you, and after you find your new favorite band on this mix, I bet you'll be really grateful. So talk more about that, Stephen.
You're putting yourself out there. You're kind of presenting your expertise to the person who's receiving it. You're kind of secretly trying to implant in them, like, you're going to fall in love with this band. And then you're going to think, like, wow, that guy's really cool. He got me into this band.
First you look so strong.
I've been making mixtapes for friends, you know, my whole life. In fact, when I first moved to Texas at the age of 13, this is how I started trying to make friends, was by offering to give people tapes. And I especially use this as a means of trying to flirt with women. But, you know, every mixtape that I made was almost like a race to see if I could put this one song on it, a song called Vapor Trail by a band called Ride. This day, I love that song like you wouldn't believe. And it's funny because the one woman on whom this never worked, my one go-to trick, is the one I married and the one with whom I'm going to spend the rest of my life.
And so if you can kind of put your mix together in such a way that it's presenting maybe a few bands that you think the other person might not know as well, that has this added level of like presenting your musical expertise, but also a little bit like your romantic expertise, if that makes sense. So there's a certain amount of vanity in presenting your musical tastes that way. But at the same time, there is a real celebration to putting a crush in music. You are celebrating that new energy that comes with having these like very fresh feelings for a new person. And so a crush mix can have this incredible energy and excitement to it.
This seems like it's kind of a dangerous game. You really need to be listening to the lyrics of songs before you put one of these on a tape, right?
I am a strong, strong proponent of always reading the lyrics to every song you put on a mixtape. You want to be careful not to pick like Every Breath You Take by The Police, you know, which is this song about stalking someone. You want to be careful, like a song that sounds really effervescent and sunny can either be more melancholy than you mean it to be or overstate your affection in a way that can come on too strong.
So the song I'm Yours by Jason Mraz, a staple or cardinal sin?
I think one of the top songs I put on there, probably like I'm Yours by Jason Mraz. Just really, you know, sappy stuff, but it's cute, so.
Well, you don't. Oh, man. I mean, I'm not really on Team Mraz. So I never necessarily want to say, though, that a song for a mix is a cardinal sin. It's probably a little strong for a crush mix. I'm Yours is a pretty powerful thing to say to somebody that you're crushing on. But I'm stuck on how I feel about the song itself, which is to say,
I'm yours.
So when I was in high school, I received a mix CD from my girlfriend at the time, and our song was Wonderful Tonight by Eric Clapton.
Hey man, that's high school.
Yeah, exactly. But she started the CD with Wonderful Tonight, and she bookended the CD at the very end with Wonderful Tonight. Was that a good idea, or was that a great idea?
Bookended it with the same song?
With the same song.
you know, speak your truth. You know? if that's your thesis statement, it's like you're writing an essay. Maybe you're restating here and kind of tidily bundling up your thesis at the end of the mix. I think if that's your song and that's the message she's trying to send, more power to her.
And I say yes, you look wonderful.
Well, the relationship didn't last, so I don't know what this says.
But Chris, how did you feel about that?
I think at the time, I thought it was a very nice gesture. I think I still have the CD somewhere. I kind of want to dig it out because I'm curious what else is on it. I can't remember. I know there's got to be some other gems on it. Halima, I believe you had another question. Moving on from my experience.
Well, okay, so the mixtape itself is not all that matters. What about the outside of the mixtape? Should you have artwork, or should you have a really snazzy title?
Oh man, that's a good question. I'm a firm believer in a snazzy title. I once put together this incredibly soul-crushingly melancholy mix and called it Steven's Summertime Smile Factory. it can be a joke, it can be a representative lyric. That's what I'm about. Artwork, because I'm not terribly artistically gifted myself.
The cover of the tapes were made by me in shop class. I used an air paintbrush gun to actually paint a rose that, if you line the cassettes up, looked like a complete picture of a rose from the stem to the top. And there were liner notes. I put liner notes and little poems on the inside of the tape. And she broke up with me. I went away to college, and she broke up with me. I wanted the relationship to keep going, so I kept sending mixtapes that summer. There were more mixtapes, tons of them, and she burnt them in a burn barrel outside of her house. You want that love and feeling.
Whoa, that love and feeling. So that was kind of an adorable story. We're going to follow that up with maybe like a less adorable story. We've been sort of soliciting some stories with people and their mixtapes. And Halima, you actually had someone call in and leave us a voicemail.
So I made a CD called Shoaib's Bag of Lovin', which pretty much tells you how over the top this was. It was a really silly name, and I'm not really sure what I was thinking, but at the time I just thought it was a really funny thing to do. What was on the mixtape? Pretty much anything that was popular in 1999. So Journey's Chronic 2001 was out then, so there were some tracks from there. Foo Fighters, Learn to Fly. I put Ice Ice Baby on there. I don't know why. All right, stop. Collaborate and listen. Ice is back with my brand new invention. Something. And then there was some like Southern rap music. Tom Petty was on there as well. So, you know, just a little bit of everything. To the extreme, I rock a mic like a vandal.
Light up a stage and wax a chump like a candle. Dance. Yeah, Shoaib's Bag of Lovin'. And he did this as a means to kind of become the life of the party. They were tailgating their high school football games, so he made this mix for that purpose. So there seems to be other spaces or other purposes for making a mixtape.
Oh, absolutely. I used to have in my car like a mix. I was absolutely in love with this pop song called Too Little Too Late by JoJo.
That song was amazing.
That song is incredible.
It's so angsty.
It's an absolute jam. And I think JoJo at the time was like 15 or 16. Mm-hmm. And she's auto-tuned like crazy. And it is such an unbelievably catchy and triumphant jam. And so I made myself a mix CD and marked it the JoJo Mega Mix, and it's just that song. And so it would come in, and I think at the time my car would just start the CD over when it finished. So you put in the CD, and all it was Too Little Too Late by JoJo over and over again. Oh, God, I was such a dork.
I was young and in love. I gave you everything, but it wasn't enough.
That was Stephen Thompson, music critic for NPR. Stephen, thanks a lot for the shout out to JoJo and My Preteen Angst.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
So, Halima, did you see the Game of Thrones season finale?
Nope.
Do you watch Game of Thrones?
Is that a board game? Just kidding. I do know what Game of Thrones is. I just don't watch it.
So you haven't been following this amazing season. There's only one season left. You're not on this train.
Nope.
Well, I'll tell you who is on this train. This is a cool thing. A while back, HBO commissioned an artist to create illustrations for each episode of the show, often based on whatever character had died that week. It's called the Beautiful Death series. Robert Ball is a UK-based illustrator, and he joins us now to talk more about it. Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good, thanks. So bring us back to the beginning here of this Beautiful Death series. How did you get your start doing this?
The fourth season four of Game of Thrones started. They wanted to remind people what had happened in the first three seasons. Mm. So their idea was to create a illustration for each death, because they'd noticed that I think in all seven seasons there's only two episodes when no one's died.
Wow.
So it gave them a hook to build a series of illustrations on. I put together a little document, a little idea of what I thought it should be like, and my idea was that each image should have an extra layer to it, so that when people look at the pictures, they hopefully see a nice, pretty image, but for hardcore fans or people who've read the books, there might be something else to look at in there, and that won me the job. And I started in 2013, and I've been doing it for every season since.
Yeah, so walk us through your process. How do you go about designing one of these images?
I watched the latest episode on Monday morning. It's actually broadcast at the same time in the UK as it is in the US, but that would mean I'd have to watch it, I think, about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Mm, sure.
And I'm committed, but I'm not that committed. So I watch it on a Monday morning over my breakfast, which is quite a weird way to start the week, because I'll be there eating my cornflakes and then somebody will be getting, you know, decapitated. So I watch that on a Monday morning, have a think about it during the day, doodle some sketches. Over the next couple of days, we kind of decide which one's appropriate, which sketch is going to work the best, and then I've got till Friday to produce the final art and send it over.
Yeah, and to be clear, HBO doesn't give you any advanced copies, any screeners or anything. You're seeing this sort of as we see it, and you have to have this finished product by Friday of the same week. How much of a time crunch do you feel when you're working on these?
I like it fast, because it just keeps you going. There's nothing worse than not having a deadline or just having too much space to worry and second-guess yourself. And the pace of it is nice. It takes me, you know, those 5 days to create an illustration that goes off, people react to it, and I'm back again doing it on the Monday. So there's no time to really sit and stew about it and, as I say, no time for second-guessing. You just have to do it, which is nice. And actually, the pace now is slower than it was originally when I did the first 30 illustrations. I was doing more like one every 2 or 3 days. So now it feels like, you know, I can just relax.
And what I like about your drawings is there's a certain subtleness to each one. I'm thinking of the drawing that you did for The Red Wedding, which is an episode where literally everybody dies. You could have easily drawn, like, just a mountain of dead bodies with blood spurting everywhere. But you went in another direction. Can you talk about that picture and how you went about doing that episode?
The challenge and the fun really is to come at it in a bleak way every time. So that scene in particular, you're looking for sort of objects, and there was the medieval band there with all the with the cellos and stuff like that. And you notice that I think the medieval cello had 4 strings and there's 4 deaths. Again, somebody on social media said, hey, your cello's got 5 strings, and I did some research and found out that the precursor to a cello at that time would have had 4 strings, so it's like, in your face! So I have to work out. I try as much as I can to be faithful. I'm sure there's lots of mistakes I've made along the way, but people usually don't give me a hard time about it.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, I know a lot of Game of Thrones fans. I know that they're passionate. You're making art for very passionate people. I also know there are some people out there who aren't Game of Thrones fans. Halima, for that
hey,
group of...
no need to call me out here.
Okay, so some people who may not be fans of Game of Thrones, who may also host a radio show, for that select group of individuals, do you think that they can still find some value in this art that you're making for fans of the show?
Oh, that's a good question, and I'm glad you're being hypothetical about it as well, and that you don't know somebody who may be a radio presenter who isn't into the program, so that's very subtle of you. I think, actually, the images are really built for people who've seen the series, so I'm sure they wouldn't make an awful lot of sense to people who've not seen the television program. Pure aesthetics, maybe, nice colours, etc. But I think they really are almost coded to only make sense of people who've seen the TV show.
So the seventh season of Game of Thrones just wrapped up. There's one more season to go. I'm hearing it's only going to be six episodes. That means only six more drawings for you. How do you feel about all of this coming to an end?
Depressed.
Yeah.
I'm hoping there's going to be like 16 million spin-off series. What I'm glad about is that the series has an end point, and that's always been the case in it. You know, the program doesn't go on and on and on, gradually decreasing in quality until somebody has to say, how do we end this thing? So I'm glad as a fan that there will be an end, and, you know, I'm just glad and I'm lucky to have been along for the ride.
Robert Ball is a UK-based illustrator and the creator of the Beautiful Death series.
To see visuals and a video of his process, go to wpr.org/entertainus.
So we've gotten pretty dark here. We've talked about our teen angst. We've talked about our favorite characters dying on Game of Thrones. So after the break, we're going to talk about the apocalypse.
Well, that's not it. There will be a comedian in there, too.
That's coming up on Entertain Us from Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Entertain Us from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Halima Shah. And oh, look at the time. It is time to talk about the end of times.
Of course it is. So we've got Sarah Goodyear with us, who's a freelance writer and a bit of an expert on the apocalypse, at least the fictional kind.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I really want to know, is it just us, or are we living in a time that is particularly interested and fascinated by the apocalypse?
Well, when I looked into it for the piece that I wrote, I found that there have been phases of interest in the apocalypse that go back, you know, certainly to medieval times and before, and a lot of even older mythology deals with the idea that the world could end. Obviously, the Noah's Ark story is sort of an apocalypse story. And then also, in our own times, when there is an actual existential threat on the horizon, I think that apocalyptic narratives become very appealing to people because it allows them to know what was really important in life. There's a very interesting apocalyptic book called Station 11, and that is an apocalypse that is brought on by a disease outbreak. So there's this terrible pandemic flu that sweeps over the globe, and she follows a group that travels around North America and does Shakespeare and music for people. And that's, to me, very interesting, that what you would try to hold on to when everything else had collapsed would be something artistic rather than just, you know, how do we get food?
So I want to get back to the piece that you wrote here. You wrote about there being several flavors of the apocalypse. You mentioned one, the disease and super virus type that was in Station 11. What are the other kinds of, I guess, apocalypses that we might see in pop culture?
Let's see, what do we have? We have disease, climate, nuclear war, Asteroid is also something that we can pretend in our minds that we would be able to do something heroic about. That's what Armageddon is really about, that movie.
What is this thing?
It's enormous.
It's an asteroid, sir. It's the size of Texas, Mr. President.
What kind of damage?
Total, sir.
My God.
Nothing would survive, not even bacteria.
What do we do?
We blow this thing up from the inside. How?
We drill. We bring in the world's best deep core driller.
The United States government just asked us to save the world.
I'm with you.
Of course I'm in.
Can't let you go up there alone.
Come on.
Beam me up, Scotty.
Aliens, of course, mm-hmm. are very popular. You know, do they come roaring in and just crush us, or do they hide amongst us and subvert us? And really, you know, I think zombies are sort of a side apocalypse where they can embody some of the same fears. The other one is sort of the fertility or the, you know, the loss of ability to reproduce. That's right. That's another. And then there's like the robot, the rise of the machine, the Terminator narrative is another one. I mean, it's really, there are just so many different ways for the world to end.
Well, it sounds like there is a lot to choose from. And when you said zombie, I saw Chris shaking his head. I mean, we can have our preferences now about what kind of apocalypse we like or don't like.
Yeah, personally, I'd go with the robot uprising, but that's just me.
Well, here's my question is, so when you talk to people about the apocalypse coming, I find people are in one of two camps. Either they think that they're the kind of person who would be able to be one of the survivors, one of the leaders, one of the people who would fight on and somehow make it through. Or I have some friends who just say, oh my God, I would be one of the first people to die. So what about you guys? Do you think that you would fare well in an apocalypse?
Survivor. Total survivor.
I'm glad you are, because I think I would die within the
really?
First 5 or 10 minutes.
No, Chris, you could make
it. You think so? Really?
I think you could. You could use, like, the power of humor to, you know, maybe, like, get people to keep you around.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think that there are some apocalyptic scenarios in fiction that have used humor to try to inject a little bit of something into a pretty bleak scenario.
I'm even thinking of Doctor Strangelove right now, which I feel like is going to have a new relevance given U.S.-North Korea relations. But that was one that really... It didn't only make fun of the idea of an apocalypse. It made fun of the idea of people who were worrying about it, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think I actually saw Dr. Strangelove again in a theater recently, and I watched it with my 15-year-old son, and it was very funny, and we laughed a lot. And even though it's so funny, it still manages to be really dark. It's a tough line to walk, but, you know, that one does it very successfully. And it's also the idea that even as you're scrambling to survive and you think that you're going to survive, that actually there's some crazy random thing happening that's dooming you anyway. So all your illusions of being a hero and being in control and being a survivor are just that. They're illusions.
Now, I know, Sarah, that you have your preferences when it comes to apocalyptic movies, and it has something to do with transportation.
Oh, yes. Well, it's just a little complaint that I have because so I wanted to develop a plan. How would I get out of New York City if there was some kind of disaster? But I ride bicycles everywhere. And so I thought, okay, we'll have a bicycle plan. But it's a real problem with apocalypse movies. People are never riding bicycles in apocalypse movies. That's exactly what people would be doing. You don't need fuel. They're easy to repair. And as a matter of fact, I can do a lot of basic bike mechanics. And so that's what I think would be my skill, that I would be able to market myself in an apocalyptic economy and maybe, you know, get my survival rations by changing tires and doing basic wrenching on a bike. So that's my plan for the apocalypse, is to be like the person who helps people with their bicycles.
Now I'm imagining writing this work of apocalyptic fiction where something happens and all the roads in America get destroyed except for the bike lanes, and that's the only thing. I think I'm onto something here. But that does remind me of something that I wanted to ask you about. It seems like filmmakers and other content creators throughout the years have sort of used the backdrop of the apocalypse to work out just whatever ridiculous scenario or concept is in their head. We were chatting before this interview about this made-for-TV movies that I saw when I was a kid. This was a movie called The Atomic Train, which came out in 1999, starring a very young
Rob Lowe. This thing was 170 minutes long, and the whole idea was there was a nuclear warhead on a train that was speeding for Denver, and it was going to blow up Denver, and Rob Lowe, I'm assuming it was him, had to stop it. It was sort of like nuclear speed,
right?
And it was this ridiculous concept, and it seems like you can come up with whatever concept you want, and you can justify it by having, you know, the apocalypse in the background, but does that excuse bad movies and bad fiction from being made?
No, it doesn't excuse it. And I think that, you know, yes, sometimes the apocalypse is just a plot device that people throw in because they're desperate and they don't have anything else to raise the stakes with. And it sounds like that Rob Lowe movie, which I had never heard of, is definitely an example of that.
Yeah, I would encourage you to stay away from that one. So, like, on both ends, stay away from the road and stay away from Atomic Train.
Okay.
So, Sarah, We never got a chance to ask you the same question of what scenario do you think you would be in? Would you be a survivor or a perisher in an apocalyptic scenario?
I would absolutely be a survivor, and I would be a leader. I would be a total badass in an apocalypse.
Nice.
I'm envisioning, like, Sarah Goodyear's, like, biker gang as they, you know, hoof it out on their 10 speeds away from, like, a radioactive New York or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe we'd be also somehow shooting bows and arrows at the same time.
Well, Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, that was really fun. Thank you.
Sarah Goodyear is a writer based in New York.
And definitely the person I'd want to be the leader of my bike gang at the end of the world.
3-4 soldier, 100 horsemen at your door. Apocalypse. 5-6.
In creating the pilot episode for this show, we found ourselves sitting through plenty of meetings. And we had meetings about meetings, and frankly, it was hard to always be present mentally for all of them. But our next guest has come up with some tips to help us breeze through them and maybe even look good in the process.
Sarah Cooper is a stand-up comedian, and her satirical blog, The Cooper Review, pokes fun at corporate culture, the tech world, and everything in between. Her book is called 100 Tricks to Appear Smart in Meetings, and she's with us now. Sarah, thanks for joining us here on Entertain Us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
But help us out. Walk us through your 10 tricks to appear smart in meetings.
So these were some tricks that I, many of them I observed. Some of them I actually did myself while I was in the tech world. And a few of them are translate percentages into fractions. So if someone says 25% of people click on this button, say, oh, about 1 in 4, and make a note of it. And people will be really impressed with your quick math skills. And that's something that I saw someone do, and I was very impressed, so I immediately wrote it down. Encourage everyone to take a step back. This is a great thing to do if everybody's just chiming in and throwing out ideas. You can kind of stop everyone and say, hey, guys, let's take a step back here. And then once you have everyone's attention, ask some, you know, vague question like, what problem are we really trying to solve? And everyone will be really impressed with your ability to kind of take the reins of the conversation. Ask the presenter to go back a slide is also a great one that I've seen a lot of people do. It just makes you look like you caught something on that slide that no one else caught, and so everybody will be really impressed with the fact that you are paying close attention, even though you're really just going to pretend to look at the slide and then say, okay, let's move on. Mm-hmm. And pacing around the room, that's something that I actually saw a VP do, get up from the table and just start pacing back and forth. You know, I got immediately scared, like, you know, what is this guy thinking? Is he going to cancel this project? Is he just going to walk out? But, you know, I knew that my respect for him went through the roof when he did that. So another great one that I did a lot was just nod continuously while pretending to take notes. Just bring in a notebook and just keep your head nodding and just write down like every other word that you hear, and it'll appear like you're really paying very close attention.
This one really hit home for me because I was talking to a music journalist, and I'm looking back on my notes from that because I have that in front of me now, and I've written down so many phrases and words, but it doesn't make sense in context. I've written down Guns N' Roses, Rivalry, Hard To, and the word your, Y-O-U apostrophe R-E, in capital letters. I cannot figure out for the life of me why I have this on the paper.
Yeah, don't ever expect to be able to make sense of your notes afterward. That's definitely true.
So, Sarah, I don't know if you're a public radio fan or not, but is there anything that we could do as public radio hosts to really, like, impress our managers in the next staff meeting that we're sitting in?
I think that, you know, drinking tea and wearing turtlenecks.
Oh, my God. I am literally doing both right now. Are you serious? Yes, I am. Well, it's not a turtleneck. It's a cowl neck, but it is.
What is a cowl neck?
It's okay. It's basically like a very wide turtleneck, and I am drinking ginger tea, which has a really stupid quote on the tea bag, too.
Well, then there's nothing that I can teach you because you are already nailing it.
Yeah, we were having a nice conversation about the terrible quotes that are on the tea bag. Helima, do you want to read your terrible
quotes?
Yeah,
absolutely. The terrible quote is, God, what if, like, there's the person who wrote this quote is listening? I feel really bad. Anyway, it's too late. The difference between a flower and a weed is a judgment.
I think you should bust that out in your next meeting.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, you can say that pretty much at any point, and people would think you were being really deep.
Yeah. And the quote is from Unknown, so technically I could take credit for it. I don't know who's going to come after me.
Do you really want to take credit for that?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a good point, Chris.
All right, well, hey, I think that covers it. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Cooper was with us. Her new book is 100 Tricks to Appear Smart in Meetings. Well, speaking of meetings, we had to have many of them to make the show happen, and we had to sit through them with these guys.
Yeah, Brad Kohlberg kept telling us to take a step back.
We also had Carl Christensen, who was mainly concerned with whether or not our ideas would scale.
And Adam Friedrich showed us he could do math by always converting percentages into fractions.
Of course he did. Well, we are your tea-sipping, turtleneck-wearing hosts. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Halima Shah.
Catch the show time after time online.
And you can tell us what you think by going to wpr.org/entertain us.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.